TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Julia Witte, For Love and Protection of the Deep Ocean. This is the second part of a one-hour reading and commentary by Julia Witte on the BP oil spill and on life near the ocean floor. Julia Witte is a diver, former nature documentary filmmaker, author, and investigative journalist. As environmental correspondent for Mother Jones magazine, she had just returned from the Gulf Coast when I met her in Sebastopol, California, in early August 2010. Not only had she visited the marshlands, but she spent time with researchers who do deep ocean work on the so-called scattering layer. In part one of this program, Witte gave a scholarly, lyrical, and moving account of the unknown and unprotected life in the deep ocean. This largest and richest ecosystem left on Earth presents the foundation of life for the creatures of the sunlit sea that we know, at least by name, or as food, from whales to tuna, dolphins, turtles, seals, and so many others. The toxic plumes of dispersed oil and dissolved methane and natural gas that we are now made to forget about are threatening the life of all ocean beings who have to travel through the toxic brew to move from sunlit sea to darkness, to hunt, hide, spawn, play, sleep, and survive. This second part of the program has a more personal cast. After reading from her new book, Deep Blue Home, the amazing story of the encounter with an ancient iceberg while diving off Newfoundland, Witte responds to a rich variety of questions about diving, close encounters with sea life, invisible rivers beneath the surface of the oceans, coral reefs, and more. Here's the story of the iceberg.
Norse sailors braving the iceberg alleys of the North Atlantic en route to the world they would call Vinland bore with them their own belief in a primeval life-bestowing deity of the sea, Egger, an ancient, a giant of the race known as Jötnar. Some Norse sagas portrayed Egger as the oldest of beings, older than the gods or the Jötnar, a mysterious, deep-rooted force whose beginnings could not be known. Egger's hall was said to be lit by floors strewn with gold, and for this reason the Norse referred to gold as the fire of the sea. His sanctuary was so warm and inviting that the younger gods arrived in their splendor each winter to avail themselves of his magically refilling tankards of beer. Egger's consort was the sea goddess Ran, keeper of the drowned, who on bad days ensnared sailors in her nets. The pair's watery, primordial couplings produced nine daughters, the billow maidens, veiled in white and named for the nine forms of waves, from gentle to wrathful. Off Newfoundland this afternoon, the billow maidens are asleep, dreaming under their blanket of fog. We nose the inflatable zodiac boat through the still air and calm water, the outboard gurgling, its exhaust cloud hovering behind us like an unwelcome guest on the stern. We expect the day to be a changeling, as are all days in this boreal world, with fog and wind and rain and sleet coming and going as Egger tosses and turns and throws off his blankets, while Ran, good housewife, washes them, wrings them out, and snaps them dry in the wind. We are motoring through their insomnolent house when out of the fog comes a patch of blue sky, and sailing through its center, an iceberg so blinding it makes us squint, so close it makes us lean away. Its skin is wind-polished to the luster of diamond, water-sculpted to sapphire. Its form purely feminine, purely voluptuous, carves hewn hard in the foundry of the far north. Although the air temperature is cold enough to make us shiver, it is not cold enough for this relic of snowfalls past to survive. And a silver cascade of meltwater pours from its summit down a chute of polished translucent turquoise. Crystal by crystal, its ice diminishes, collecting in a pool on the iceberg saddle, where Arctic terns dip and splash, unfurling freshwater rainbows. Deep blue veins and track marks of gravel scar the ice, records of good years and bad years in the glacial world. Somewhere in these layers are the remains of blizzards circa the year 1000, when Leif Erikson, son of Erik the Red, left Greenland and tried and failed to found a colony in Vinland. Somewhere in this white book of ice is the meteorological memory of the year 1010 or so, when Thorfinn Karlsefni, sailing from Iceland with three ships and 160 settlers, succeeded for three brief years in inhabiting the New World. The Vikings made their voyages here at a time when the North Atlantic was freer of ice than it is today, and the climate warm enough to support their livestock in Greenland and Newfoundland. Somewhere in this floating remnant of the glaciers lie passages from those Norse lives, remnants of their wood smoke or dung smoke, wool fibers from their sheep, traces of human hair. But the naked eye is not discerning enough for such far-off tales, so we scan the ocean for another story. The fresh water from the melting iceberg swirls on the surface in an oily-looking lens. Air bubbles freed from the melting of submerged ice rise and bob against this freshwater cap, dimpling the surface as if rain were falling upward from underwater. The illusion is reinforced by the spritzing we receive from the bubbles bursting and exhaling their 15,000-year-old air. As quickly as we can in the cold, we change out of our parkas and into our wetsuits. It's 1984, and my partner in our newborn documentary film business and I are trying to become film professionals. This is a vocation without textbooks or compasses, and our transition involves traveling the world, disencumbered by the customary hallmarks of professionals like budgets and contracts. Instead, we cling to hope, that 7/10 submerged vessel, which will either sink us or float us to the far-flung regions of our dreams. We're also disencumbered by gear. We have neither exposure suits for topside work nor dry suits for underwater work. Therefore, we're cold before we even enter the water. Slipping overboard in our ill-fitting neoprene, cameras in hand, we are smacked with the full-strength experience of the North Atlantic, a wave of icy water not cold enough to keep an iceberg frozen, yet frigid enough to ice pick through us to the marrow of our bones. It doesn't matter, though, because the underwater world is like a jolt of electricity, the sea fizzing with bubbles, a glitter in a floodlight of ice. The sides of the iceberg are furred with newly born bubbles cavorting upward in trembling clouds, half-formed creatures that break apart and disintegrate against the ceiling of the sea. Mists of bubbles envelop us, tickling the bare skin of our faces and whitening the undersides of our wetsuits. It's cold, but intoxicating, like diving in Egger's aquamarine beer. Nor are we alone. An enormous shadow looms below. We strain to make it out within the veil of bubbles, a shadow, and then not a shadow. It's one creature, and then not one, but thousands of creatures, a shoal of silvery fish, the sardines of the north, known as capelin. They huddle in the center of the bubble curtain, hiding. From what? We're not sure. And then we see, shooting up from below, two hooded seals speeding through the carbonation on the propellers of their hind flippers. Their splotchy silver and black coats paints a natural camouflage in the swirl of bubbles. The capelin know all about hooded seals, however, and recombine into one organism, flashing their shiny bellies before disappearing into the smoke screen of their darker backs, fighting to elude their predators with weapons of optical illusion. The seals know all about optical illusions, however, and torpedo into the smoke screen. The shoal disintegrates into 1,000 shards of fish, and the fight spirals downward in a silvery tornado. We free dive after it, descending the ice haunches through the darkening beer, where the groaning voice of the berg, a low woodwind interspersed with rifle fire pops, sounds a warning, perhaps from the formidable Ron herself. The drama fades into the shadows beyond our reach, and we return breathless to the surface. Our last sight is of the sparkling fish merging with the splotchy seals until we can no longer tell where one species begins and the other ends. We lurch frozen into the zodiac, gasping on our backs like hooked fish, though our disappointment is soon assuaged by the appearance of a minke whale. This sleek wanderer of the ice realm is the smallest of the great whales, at only 25 feet in length and 5 tons in weight. It is a graceful presence, coursing through the bubbly sea on lithe flukes, curious about us, but difficult to approach, and quick to disappear, as coy as a sea nymph. We try for some topside shots, but the magic of this species includes its contortionist ability to transform itself on film into something worse than invisible, its dark gray dorsal fins skipping through the gray wave tops like an unwanted piece of dust on the film negative. Minkes never throw their flukes into the air when sounding, but only tease, rolling with an arched tailstock and no flukes. But we know that they do occasionally breach, that is, throw themselves completely out of the water, and that they sometimes do this repeatedly. So we follow from a hopeful distance, even though breaching is hard to catch on film, particularly at a time when documentary budgets are calculated like lumber by the board foot of exposed film. The minke is also hunting capelin, and if we're lucky, we might see it course up through a ball of fish, jaws wide, gulping. That would be worth at least an entire 400-foot magazine of 16-millimeter film. Egger's daughters are quiet enough at the moment to inflate this hope further, allowing us to peer through the surface and see the whale's pretty countershading, dark gray above, white underneath, a capelin-like ruse that matches the whale with the sky when seen from below and with the darker abyss when seen from above, hiding it from both predators and prey. We are also hoping to see the seals again, so we drift farther from the iceberg, widening our circle of possibility. While we wait, Arctic terns fly to and from the meltwater pool. The bubbles rise and pop. The whale stubbornly, unbreachingly, remains beyond useful camera range. While we wait, Ron awakens, stirring the wind and effectively dropping the temperature by 20 degrees, slapping the waves into lops, as the Newfoundlanders called them, small breaking seas that splash into the zodiac. Still we wait, wet, shivering, blue, as Guy, our French-Canadian companion, regales us, teeth chattering, with stories of diving on icebergs, of entering their secret underwater caves and finding seals inside sleeping on dry ledges. We are bitterly cold in more ways than one when we abandon the day and make landfall to haul the endless cases of camera gear up the long hill toward the car. We are frozen and wet and feeling sorry for ourselves about the missed seals, the missed underwater sleeping caves, the capelin mob, which doubtless the minke whale is feasting on right now. Our misery, internal and silent, does not prevent us from hearing the monstrous rumbling detonation in the bay behind us. Surely some war has begun, we imagine, in that instant when we turn, wet neoprene booties squelching, to see the iceberg turning upside down, its huge underwater keel slicing like a blue fluke into the air and listing in the wind before disintegrating into a debris field of slush and brash ice, skidding across hundreds of yards of ocean surface. In less than 1 minute, this far traveler from the far north, this Jotun from ice ages past, has disappeared from being, relinquishing its molecules back to the ocean, one less ancient to animate our giantless age. Thank you.
That was Julia Witte reading from her new book, Deep Blue Home. She's a documentary filmmaker turned author, investigative reporter, and environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. What follows now is a collage of answers that are personal, lyrical, or scientific to questions from the audience, beginning with mine about her story of the invisible rivers beneath the surface of the seas. Julia Witte.
We've arbitrarily named these ocean basins Pacific, Atlantic, Indian, and whatnot, but more oceanographers look at the ocean, we realize now that, in fact, all of the waters of the world are connected, so that a drop that falls in the North Atlantic actually flows through this incredibly complex system of rivers in the ocean. so that it arises again in the North Pacific maybe 1,600 or 2,000 years later. And if you were to look at an exploded view of the movement of ocean waters, which oceanographers call the Great Ocean Conveyor or the thermohaline circulation, it looks like an exploded view of highway interchange overpasses. So you have, for instance, like the surface Gulf Stream, we all know that, a very powerful wind-driven surface flowing current that runs up the eastern seaboard of the United States, bringing warm water up into the, it's what keeps Europe warmer than Alaska, which it's at the same latitude as. But as that warm Gulf Stream water reaches the Arctic, it overgoes a critical change, what's known as an overturning circulation, rapidly loses its warmth to cold winds of the north, and temperature and salinity are the chemistry of the ocean. As the water gets colder, it gets saltier, and it sinks, and it plummets like a stone up there in the north. There's like 3 to 5 places where this great overturning circulation goes on. And then a large part of that water turns around very deep, like 17,000 feet deep, and it flows directly back south underneath the Gulf Stream. It's actually the same water separated by time. And it comes right back. It goes all the way down to Antarctica, where it hooks up with this great deep current that's the coldest, deepest, saltiest water on Earth that flows around Antarctica and leaks, seeps up underneath the waters of all the basins, the Indian, the Pacific, the Atlantic, and flows back up, eventually gets pushed up and warms up. So you should look it up online because it's a really cool schematic of the Great Ocean Conveyor, sometimes called the Ocean Conveyor Belt or the thermohaline circulation. And this is what drives our climate. And I talk about the ancients knew this. You know, the Greek god of the ocean was Oceanus, and he was believed and understood to be not just a god of the ocean, but also of the atmosphere. And the Greeks somehow understood that ocean and atmosphere were coupled. They moved together. You know, when you have some huge amounts of ocean water moving this way with winds are blowing with it and dragging it, and all this stuff is totally interconnected. The same with Eger and other gods I talk about. So we're coming full circle now and understanding some of the things that the ancients knew about how truly coupled all the systems of our planet are. And the ocean is really the great arbiter of our climate. Well, what was my most intimate experience in the ocean with a creature? Well, I have a few in here, which I'll leave you to discover. One of the wonderful things about ocean life, this is one of the things that I love, and probably you may all well be ocean lovers as well, but, you know, when you go out on the water, you don't ever know what you're going to see. And you know that below, you know, even if you're just in a boat on the surface, and you know that at any moment, anything could rise from the deep. Huge whales and manta rays throwing themselves out of the water and billfish leaping, and you don't even know what you could find, and it's always an adventure. And when you go into the water with marine life, most of the time, it doesn't have an acquired fear of human beings. So, you know, Charles Darwin wrote wonderfully and vividly of encountering the wildlife of the Galapagos, which was remarkable to him because it was unafraid of people because no one had ever lived there. Well, a lot of the ocean is like that. If you go underwater, most marine life that isn't in an area where people are, say, spearfishing or something, they aren't frightened of you and they're curious about you. And an awful lot of creatures will come over to meet you and try to figure out who you are and what you know. And if you're in a certain area that you go back to time after time, you can get to know these inhabitants. They'll become your friends. They'll come and greet you on every dive. Yeah, it's a miraculous world, and it's full of intimate moments. It's hard for me to pick one out because there's so many of them. What type of fish am I? Oh, boy, that's a good question. Well, because I'm air-breathing, I would have to go with a marine mammal of some kind. And I'm going to completely not answer this question. The thing is, when we get in the ocean, is we realize how pathetic we are, you know? I mean, no matter if you are like an Olympic-grade swimmer, you suck underwater compared to everything else. You know, we don't see well underwater. We have to wear a mask and it cuts our peripheral vision. We don't hear well. We have non-directional hearing underwater. Our hearing is not evolved for the underwater. We can't hear where it's coming from, and we also can't hear many of the frequencies we can hear on topside. So we're very deaf underwater. We can't smell or taste anything underwater because we drown. And we are hypersensitive to touch, so that even like accomplished divers who've been diving a long time, you always kid each other by coming up behind some dive buddy and just tapping him, and they just flinch, you know, like they've been speared by a sailfish or something, because you don't know what, all these other senses are so shut down. You're aware you're very vulnerable down there all the time. I couldn't possibly identify with any of them because I am this weird, clumsy, disabled alien in their midst, who at the best is trying to make out with a very poor sense of sight in the underwater world, which is not designed for sight but designed for sound, barely make out what's going on. And I guess I'd be something pathetic, like, you know, a single-celled organism just sitting there, unable to go anywhere. Yeah. So what can people do about the endangered species in the, you know, this is going to lead to my subversive talk, which I'll keep short, but
go for it.
You know, what's acceptable to us as we learn about some of these really intense changes underway? Another, I go, God, I really like that species. I don't think I'll eat that one anymore. And my list just got longer and longer. And eventually I just said, you know, I don't think I want to eat fish anymore or any of these things. And then, in all honesty, I eventually got around to the point where I realized that eating fish is eating wildlife. Most of us don't eat wildlife of the land. Most of us aren't going to go out and eat any wildlife. And when we eat a tuna is not a cow equivalent on land. A tuna is a fourth or fifth level trophic predator. It's the equivalent of a cheetah. It's incredibly fast, it's incredibly powerful, it's actually smart, it's an amazing species, it's an amazing animal, and it is the equivalent of basically going into the ocean and eating its cheetahs. And as I came around to develop that form of thinking and realizing there's no way I'm going to eat cheetahs, I'm not going to go to Africa and sit in the game park all day, and then at dinner I'm going to say, hey, serve me up one of them cheetahs. You know, there's no way I'm going to do that. And that's what so many people, they go into the ocean, they look at, it's beautiful, I love it. Give me your cheetahs for dinner. So I have really come around to a place now where for me, I can't justify eating that. And not to mention, before even going into the methods of capture of the cheetah involve bulldozing the entire savanna of the ocean to get those few couple of cheetah. So the whole thing becomes unsupportable in my view. And again, it's a personal decision. I don't even ask anybody else to make this decision. I simply explain the decision that I've come to over time based on the more I've learned, the more I've come to know and learn. Question in the back.
What are the cows?
The cows are first level consumers. Okay, those are things that exist eating only primary producers that make life from non-life using, for instance, sunlight. So in the sea, there are herbivorous fish who eat algae. They eat marine plants, okay? And so there are types of fish that do that. And in fact, we have now, in a lot of parts of the world, like in some of the most degraded coral reef ecosystems, like throughout the Caribbean, we've lost the coral reefs of the Caribbean too. They're mostly gone. As a result, we're left with what used to be coral-dominated ecosystems. We now have, in essence, lettuce-dominated ecosystems, sort of ocean lettuce, basically, you know, marine plants. And again, it really comes back to us taking a fundamental look at our choices, you know, and the way we're willing to support ourselves. What will we accept, knowing the costs? These are important things that we're learning about, and I'm glad we have the tools to start to know these things, because the more we understand the consequences of our decisions, hopefully we can taper our decisions in the future. We can, you know, change the course of the ship and make better decisions as we go forward. That's my hope. I'm sure it's everyone's hope. you know, the ocean has been mitigating most of the carbon dioxide emissions that we have been putting out into the atmosphere, and the ocean has been taking up most of this excess carbon dioxide. So we've had actually less effect than we might have imagined based on the amount of emissions, but it's not without consequence in the ocean, and part of that is it's changing the pH of the ocean, which is becoming now more acidic, and that affects the abilities of all the little creatures, anybody who makes a shell, even those who make bones to some extent, to create their calcium carbonate shells or bones. And so studies done recently found that by taking little animals, shell-building animals, and dropping them in ocean acidity that's expected by about the year 2050, and the animals just dissolved within 48 hours. So there will be some ability to adapt somewhat to changing pH, but if it changes too fast and too much, which it's kind of starting to do, then that could really affect the ability of many animals, including all the animals that build coral reefs, the stony reef builders, to create their homes and build these important structures that shelter so much life and feed so many people and also protect so many shorelines. We depend on these things too. It's not just an academic notion that we should keep all this stuff going just because it's nice out there. We actually depend on life to make our world livable. Our world is only livable because of the actions of living things. And we have to protect all of these if we will have a livable future. I think I'll end on that note. And thank you very much for coming out. Thank you.
That was a collage of answers by Julia Witte to questions from a visibly moved audience. Witte is the author of Deep Blue Home, a former documentary filmmaker, diver, investigative science reporter, and environmental correspondent for Mother Jones. I filmed her in her small hometown of Sebastopol, California, in early August 2010. She had just returned from covering the BP oil spill for Mother Jones magazine. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. I posted links to her website, her article, and a short YouTube film. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glöden. Thank you for listening.